what I want to try to accomplish today, you know, we can run through this thing at a very rapid pace, but I don't want to do this because I want to go as if we are there in the journey. All right? So today we will go through it, but a little bit later. We'll go through it because now this is the 24th day of the first month. 3 days journey from the 15th day. Before we go there, I want to backtrack just a little bit because, like, if you were looking backwards in time, where you've been, where you are, and you kind of look back to this, you know, where'd all this begin? Okay? So, we're going to begin. I want a reader. We're just going to read through the 13th chapter and the 14th chapter, and I'll make a few comments about them. I'm not going to go into detail because an awful lot of you have already gone through some of the detail with me already. So I just want to have a backtrack and kind of have a picture of us going from a given point and going forward so we can see the 24th day of the first month.
Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Consecrate to me all the firstborn, whatever opens the womb, among the children of Israel, both of man and beast. It is mine." And Moses said to the people, "Remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of this place. No leavened bread shall be eaten. On this day you are going out in the month Abib. And it shall be, when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, 'This is done because of what the Lord did for me when I came up from Egypt.' It shall be as a sign to you on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that the Lord's law may be in your mouth. For what a strong hand the Lord has brought you out of Egypt. You shall therefore keep this ordinance in its season from year to year. And it shall be, when the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, as he swore to you and your fathers, and gives it to you, that you shall set apart to the Lord all that open the womb, that is, every firstborn that comes from an animal which you have, the males shall be the Lord's. But every firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb, and if you will not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. And all the firstborn of men among your sons you shall redeem. So it shall be, when your son asks you in time to come, saying, 'What is this?' that you shall say to him, 'By strength of hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage.' And it came to pass, when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go, that the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. Therefore I sacrifice to the Lord all males that opened the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem. It shall be as a sign on your hand and as frontlets between your eyes, for by strength of hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt." Then it came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near, for God said, "Lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt." So God led the people around by way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went up in orderly ranks out of the land of Egypt. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had placed the children of Israel under solemn oath, saying, "God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here with you." So they took their journey from Sukkot and camped in Etham at the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so as to go by day and night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people. 14. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pi Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon. You shall camp before it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, They are bewildered by the land. The wilderness has closed them in. Then I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. Now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants were turned against the people, and they said, Why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us? So he made ready his chariot and took his people with him. Also he took 600 choice chariots and all the chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with boldness. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen, and his army, and overtook them camping by the sea beside Pi Hahiroth before Baal Zephon. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, Let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians, for it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. And Moses said to the people, Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again, no more forever. The Lord will fight for you. And you shall hold your peace. And the Lord said to Moses, Why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward. But lift your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, his chariots, and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. And the angel of God, who went before the camp of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud and darkness to the one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. And the Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. Now it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud. And he troubled the army of the Egyptians. And he took off their chariot wheels, so that they drove them with difficulty. And the Egyptians said, Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. And the Lord said to Moses, Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, on their chariots and on their horsemen. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. And when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth, while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Then the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. But the children of Israel had walked on dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. So the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses.
Okay, so I'm just going to make some notes or comments of what we've already gone through most of this, but I just want to make a backtrack on a few things that you remember what I have said, and not what I said, but what is written. Okay. First in chapter 13, verse 3, he says, "By a strength of the hand of Yahuwah brought you out of this place." Remember, they didn't run. They weren't cowards. They were in ranks, at least five separate columns. That says they came out in five. So they weren't running. They weren't terrified. They came out with a high hand. Okay, and so I got to remember that. And it's kind of important because, you know, sometimes, as I said before, Hollywood likes to make it more dramatic than it really is. But the truth is, if they ever saw the whole group move in precise order, you would know it was a hand of God, and you'd be awestruck of God's strength. But they kind of made them look like they were kind of running for their lives most of the time. Drop down verse 9 to 13, it says, "There'll be a sign talking about what's taking place on this night," that is the time when they were fleeing, not fleeing, they were leaving, and leaving on the 15th, and they were there to count the firstborn. Okay? And he said, "The sign between you, your hand, and the memorial between your eyes." Now, what do you think that means? Well, literally, it means that your hands are going to participate within the memorial. When you reach the land that I'm going to bring you into, you're going to participate within it, and you will see with your own eyes what I am doing. So when we actually, as individuals, we try our very best to do a, what's called a Passover or some kind of semblance thereof, we see, try to see or understand by what we do, our actions with our hands, what we do, putting together the program, and actually seeing things with our own eyes of what's taking place. So it kind of teaches us continually, and the children learn from that. You know, I'll move to verse 18, it says, "Elohim led the people about through the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea. The children of Israel went up in five out of the land of Egypt." We'll make sure that you know, get that picture that they were not running away. They were actually in precise order and was not in a mess of chaos and confusion. They followed the cloud. They did what the cloud, what direction the cloud was going. And so they followed in precise pattern in order. Now, I'd like to remember I told you that what the word Yahuwah comes from a verb. And what does that verb mean? I came. All right? So it's kind of interesting that when you read a few things in Exodus, the 14th chapter, verse 4, "And I will harden," we'll talk about that later, "Pharaoh's heart, and he shall follow after them, and I will honor. And I will be honored upon Pharaoh and upon all his hosts, and the Egyptians may know that I am," or "I came." So I'm using the word "I came," and so they did. Interesting thing, I want to turn to briefly, just a couple of quick statements. On the 17th verse of the 14th chapter, there's an interesting statement that was made. We said not one of them survived, none of them lived. And here is a quote that seemed to come from what maybe somebody was alive at that point in time. And the only thing I'm saying is it's kind of funny. He says, "I will And behold, that's not the right verse, was it? I want to go to. Maybe it's a little later. A little later. We're at first here, the 17th chapter here. He says, behold, I will harden. Now I want to talk about strengthen. Basically, he let Pharaoh think that he can go after the people and not be afraid to enter the water. It gave him strength. Strength. His heart wasn't terrified. Have your hearts ever been terrified? Yes, it has been. How does it become strong? No longer is it terrified. Well, the situation passes, doesn't it? And all of a sudden, it's not as bad as you think it really was. So when we think about the word harden, which, by the way, it was, we know that Joshua was, his heart was hardened, but we don't translate it that way. We charge his heart was strengthened. In other words, every time when fear was going to come upon one of the Israelites, upon the leadership of Israel, at any time in all the Torah, or even the entire Tanakh, the word is that God strengthened his heart. Why? Because he's afraid. When fear overcomes you, you need to have strength to overcome the fear. And when you really read what's going on in Pharaoh, you find out that his fear was removed. God took away the fear, and then he actually became stronger. Or he strengthened himself and wasn't afraid anymore. How many times did he say, oh, please, take away, And they take it away, because he's afraid. I mean, the man was not a brave man. He was a brave man, but he was not able to handle the many things that took place. On Exodus, the 25th chapter, 14, verse 25. It's very interesting. He took off their chariot wheels, and they drove them heavily. And so the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for Yahuwah fights for them against Elohim. Now, if they're all died, how do they know anything was said? Well, more than likely, guess who talked to Moses? All right. More than likely, this must have been told to Moses after the fact in order for Moses to be able to record that. And only the angel of Elohim was there, and perhaps with other angels, to dismantle the chariots. They probably heard the voices of the Egyptians, and so he recorded it and told, by the way, and Moses, what they said? Okay? Because none of them survived, not one. That's what it says, right? So we have to kind of take, so how did they get that information? All right? That was a quick rundown. So it's kind of like you're looking back on the 15th day, and you're gone through, and you're entered in now, and you finished the 20, you're in the, basically, 21st day, which is the 15th chapter, introduces that. Next week, I don't think I have time. Hey, it's almost 2 o'clock. All right, let me think about this for a moment. Now, next week, I'm going to have Dave read out of his King James Version part of the 15th chapter, and that's called the Song of Moses. If it's written as mine is written, it's in a very good format. And it's kind of interesting of what's being said. We know we have a song, we sing with it, right? Going into the sea. But to kind of read it with some kind of emphasis and with strength, it's kind of going to be more of a impressive, I think, personally speaking. I'd read it myself, but I don't have a dyslexia problem, so I'm going to mess up the verse here and there and there and here. So I have to depend on somebody who doesn't have that problem, So we're going to move ahead here now. And I want to go to Exodus, the 15th chapter, and we're going to go drop all the way down to verse 22. All the way down to 22. Exodus 15, chapter 15, verse 22. And Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Sur. Talk about that a little later. And they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. 3 days. Now just count. They finished here and stay there. 1, 2, 3. The Sabbath. what happened on that day. A very fast day. Now, you can't count. I don't mind you. You can say, this is 1, 2, and 3. That's fine. Because the very next verse says, and they went to another place to get water. You can read it one way or the other. I'm not going to go into one way or the other. I'm just going to tell you where they ended up. And they found no water. And when they came to Marah, they could not drink the water of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, the name of it was called Marah, which is bitterness. All right. 3 days after they crossed the Red Sea, they stayed there for that day, and they went on. Now, we talked about encampments. Let me ask you a question. What was the 7 days of unleavened bread for? What was the 7 days of unleavened bread for? I'm sorry, what? Okay. Sorry, what? Okay. We need to go to the Apostle Paul for a moment. What did he say? A what?
Unleavened bread, sincerity and truth.
Sincerity and truth. Okay. For 7 days, you and I, symbolically, understand this now, we're taught truth, 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 truth for 7 days. Right? That's what it's all about. And do we take it in sincerely? Or do we not take it in sincerely? Now, as Israelites had a problem, didn't they? They had a hard time taking it in. Truth, 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 truth. What happened on the first day of truth? What happened on the 15th day of truth? I'm using those words now because that's what I want to parallel to. They came out. What did they have to do?
They
what?
Left in a hurry.
Leave the old place.
No, 15th. They did it on the. They put the blood on the 14th, people. Remember, the Catholic animal was killed on the 14th day at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That blood had been put upon their post before the 15th day began. So get that story in mind. Don't put them as a conglomerate of one. God is very precise in precise detail, precise time, precise when, and when to do it. All right, so let's get past that. Now, they left, right? What were they required to do when they reached Sukkot, which they reached Sukkot on the 15th day in the morning? What were they required to do?
Camp.
They had what?
Camp.
What? Sanctify the firstborn. That's a requirement. Right? You remember that? Right? Do you remember also something that said, the firstborn is mine? Firstborn male, we read that. And then this unusually odd statement that came up. Can anybody in the room explain it? Oh, if the firstborn of an ass or a donkey, if you do not take the life of a lamb, you will have to break the neck. Therefore, the firstborn men of Israel is mine. What does that mean? Where's that at? Why is it declared? Is it kind of a warning? If you do not, in a sense, redeem your firstborn son, his life will be required.
Was that? Oh, hello. Is that the same symbology of Yeshua riding in on the donkey?
Yes, very strong symbolicness of it. But I want to come back and ask you, we have to think, right? I'm here to try to have you answer the questions before me giving you the answer. Because I need to hear it from you. Otherwise, all I know is you're just hearing what I'm saying and accept it. That's no good. That's not what it's for. Why must the firstborn Why is a firstborn connected with the firstborn of the of you, firstborn male? Why is it connected to a donkey?
It's the donkey is a creature of burden, and like Jacob said, Reuben was his strength, that you know, the excellency of his.
All right. She answered the question. I'm good. It is a symbol of burden, a symbol of responsibility, symbol that you are to take on and do what the firstborn is supposed to do. And we read it in what book? What? Genesis, 49th chapter, about what the function of a firstborn is. So, we see it does not just represent Messiah. It represents the actions, what the firstborn is supposed to do. If the firstborn does not do his function, what happens to the firstborn? His neck gets broken in a symbolic method. Got to take the life of the donkey. How do you spare the life of the firstborn? You give a life of a lamb in place of that donkey. Okay? That's the redeeming of the firstborn. Yes?
What does the lamb represent then?
That's the ultimate sacrifice.
Okay.
It does represent the ultimate sacrifice. Each one of us, each one of us in our family, we must take and kill the lamb itself and symbolically for it, because you want that. We have to recognize the death of the Messiah. His death prevented the death of my son.
Okay.
That's what it boils down to, okay? And so when we take the physical, let it be the in your frontlet, between your eyes and your hands. So when you actually participate and do that kind, when they did that, when they entered the promised land, and they actually did that, their hands were very much involved.
Right.
To spare the life of their son. All right? Because they said, why do you do this? Well, because of what God did for us and what it's all about. I think they understood it more than we do today. But I didn't want to put that in perspective. Okay? Now, let's go on here. First, verse 20. I'm reading from a different translation for a reason, because I think it's a better translation for what I want to teach today. Verse 22 of Exodus 15. And Moses caused Israel to journey from the Red Sea, and so they go out into the wilderness of Seir. We'll go through that. And they go 3 days into the wilderness and have found no water. And they came to a place called Marah, as they named it later, and they were not able to drink the water of Marah. For they, the waters, are bitter. Therefore hath one called its name Marah. And verse 24, and the people murmured, explain that word, against Moses, saying, what should we drink? And he cried out to them, Moses did, and Yahu showed him a tree. And he cast it into the waters, and the water became sweet. There he hath made for them a statue, an ordinance, for he hath tried them. Verse 26. If thou hast really hearkened unto the voice of Yahuwah thy Elohim, and does that which is right in his eyes, and have hearkened unto his commandments, to keep his statutes, none of the sickness which I laid upon Egypt shall lay upon thee, Yahuwah. Yahuwah am healing thee. Pretty powerful statement, isn't it? What's murmur mean? Kind of cool, right? Oh, wait, slow down. Murmuring has, this Hebrew word has two main functions, but they're all parallel to one another. One of them means a place to lodge, a place to camp, a place to dwell. Same exact Greek word, Hebrew word, in the verb form turns into a different meaning. It does come up. But the ancient word, it means to stop. I'm going to stop traveling. I'm going to stay. I'm going to remain where I'm at. So you kind of understand a little bit about this word by the use of the word murmuring here, because the Israelites were not wanting to go any farther. They wanted to stop. What did they want to do? They wanted to return. A little late. The water is not going to open up for them again. And so we have this murmuring, and we have the thing to understand how it works. And Nelson, the word means to lodge or to stop over, as well as to grumble, complain, murmur, because you stop listening. Then what do you say here now? I'm out here to test you. What am I testing you for? If you will hearken unto my words, are you going to stop? And are you going to hear me? Yes or no? Are you going to not see what I'm doing? Or are you going to stop going where I am taking you? Now, what about bitter waters? What do you think about that?
It's all bitter.
It's all bitter.
I thought it was the real. I was looking for a scientific explanation. I don't remember what it was. I read it in The Bible is History at one point years ago, but it's bitter water, and there's something in the plant that could, or acidic water possibly, that was taste bitter. Is that what you're asking? And something in the tree stump when they threw it in.
Okay, we'll talk about
could
that.
Could have brought the pH up.
We're going to look and see what it says. It's very, very fascinating. Yes, Ellie.
It's not like God didn't know that that water was bitter and said, oh, double darn, I forgot that that bitter water was bad. I wonder if the water would have turned sweet had they drunk it.
If they had what?
If they had drunk it. I wonder if God would have turned it sweet. It's not like he didn't know that. They complained to Moses. They didn't complain to God.
Correct.
So maybe they could have done it differently.
That's open for discussion here. I just love this. I love this.
I was wondering if there's kind of some symbolism here, because it's like when you first come to the Lord and he's leading you somewhere, it can very often become bitter at the circumstances because you're being tested to see if you're going to keep on trusting anyway. And then the reference to the tree being thrown in, it's almost like a picture of the tree of life, which is the word of God and Torah, and that can make things sweet.
All right. So we're getting your symbolism is your gut symbolism is correct. You understand what's going on here. It is bitter. Now, God deliberately led them there. Yes, Bill.
You said a week or two back that the bitter waters could represent our own life when we... See, how'd you say that? It's not always going to be sweet waters all the time.
Bitter is never sweet water.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to run into bitter waters. It's not always going to be sweet. That's what you were saying last couple of
days. When you drink bitter water, what does it do to you? How many of you drank bitter water for? physically drank water that was downright, could make you sick on the moment and the spot. All right? Go ahead.
Well, you wouldn't drink it a second time, I'll tell you that.
Water is a symbolism of a lot of things, right? Now, this particular water, something had to happen to it so it would not kill, but would give life. And so, when he cried out, Moses cried out to God, said, "What?" And you know, he said, "But what are we going to do about this?" And I said, "Well, hey, look, I'm going to show you a tree." He didn't show the congregation or the group of Israelites the tree. The only person that saw the tree was Moses. And so one of two things took place. He either took something from the tree, because it's really hard to pick up a tree and throw it in there, right? He probably took something from the tree. What do you think he might have taken from the tree? He took from that tree something that would heal them. How do I know what healed it? Because that's what he said. Didn't he say that? I am healing thee. He comes to this bitter place, this place where there's could kill you. And he says, I'm healing you in the process. I am purifying you. I'm bringing you into the realm of holiness, purity. The first thing I have to show to you is, you've got an awful lot of stuff in you that's downright unholy. Now, Bill.
In Psalms, first part of Psalms, it mentions the trees along the water. The
water, fine, yes. That's along the water, right.
Does that have to do with this?
It can, but yes, but I'm not going to go there today.
Okay.
I just want to backtrack and have you take a look, and it says, if thou dost really hearken to the voice of Yahuwah thy Elohim, and does that which is right in his eyes, and has hearkened unto his commandments, and keep his statutes, not of the sickness which I laid upon Egyptians will I lay upon. Oh, wait a minute. Do you mean God actually lays sickness on people? I thought he was a good guy. I didn't know he made people sick. You think God can make people sick? Can God make you sick? Did he make the Israelites sick? Yes, he did. The first day they came out. By the way, this is the first encampment. First encampment after the days of unleavened bread. This is the first encampment after they've walked through truth. Yes.
Couldn't that be more general, though? When I first read it, I thought this would be, you know, referring to the plagues, diseases, the boils and things.
Well, yeah, but Hebrew's got a disease. It is disease, sickness. I'll make you sick.
All sicknesses.
It's a sickness, yeah. He even said them in the book of Deuteronomy, if you don't follow thee, I will put more sickness or disease upon you that was not listed in Deuteronomy that you've never heard of before, and no one's ever heard of before. Wow. You mean he actually knows how to make people sick? Of diseases that we never knew existed before? Does he bring them on? Or do we bring them on? He's created everything that makes us well. He's also created everything that makes us sick. The devil didn't make up things. He can't create sickness. He didn't know how to put things together. He can't create anything. Neither can you. But when you start mixing things together, because you have that ability to do, so does he do. But God had to create every germ, every disease, every ailment that you could think of. He is the creator thereof it. We have to kind of... Sometimes we look at God as, oh, my, I didn't know that was going to happen. Oh, I didn't know that was going to occur. Oh, my, it's a disease. No. He's the one that is in complete control of your health, your body, your mind, your soul, and your spirit. He knows everything about you. He knows what makes you sick. He knows what makes you well.
How's that go? Yahweh is all in all, and there was nothing that was created that wasn't created by Him.
I'm sorry, what?
He is all in all.
Yeah.
There's nothing that is that wasn't created by
Correct.
Him.
Everything. Everything that has any kind of life in it, every germ that's live, it didn't come from the dead. Life cannot come from the dead. It has to come from the Creator. Yes.
So you're saying sickness came from God?
That's what he said.
But I thought
I will make you sick.
If he's live, how could
the opposite of it come from him? He's also the creator of the flood.
I thought he allows that or he manipulates however he does.
There is nothing in the Word of God that says he allows. He is in total control.
Well, I'm not disputing that. I'm saying
there is
sickness,
nothing. The word says sin. He allowed me
that.
To do this. He didn't allow me to sin. I allow myself to sin.
Sure.
He allows me to what? Obey or not obey. But what happens when I don't obey? Am I really allowed? He says, if you disobey me, guess what the consequences are?
Sickness,
you're going
sin,
to get,
death.
You're going to get in trouble.
Sure. But I don't think that comes from him, though.
Why wouldn't it?
It says he kills and he makes alive. That's scripture.
Why would he not?
I agree with that.
Why would
but
he not?
To say, you know, God is light, God is love, God is
did
life.
Did God bring forth the plagues? Yes or no? We think, oh, he allowed it. No, he actually brought them forth. As we go into the book of Numbers, we're going to see he brought forth the plagues. The plagues came from the Lord. It didn't come from the devil. It didn't come from the enemy. It didn't come from disease from the ground. It came from him. And Moses, Aaron, had to go out of his way, run as fast as he can to save the lives of those people in the middle of that killing.
Okay, then how do you interpret the whole thing with Job and Satan being up
says
there?
The same thing.
Asking him to go, like, throw plagues and all kinds of things.
Who's
on
in charge?
Him. Well, Satan went down there and inflicted
who
him
was
with
in
all
charge? Who was
yeah,
in charge?
Yeah, because he asked God if he could, and then God said,
that's
go ahead.
That's as far as he could go. He cannot do anything beyond that point. Did God create, quote, the devil, end of quote? Did he create this being called Lucifer?
Sure.
Yes or no? What did Lucifer do?
Sinned.
And guess what? He's going to lose his life. We have this picture in our mind that God would never do us any harm. He's full of love, 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 and compassion. But he says over and over again, I will curse you. Though we have a song, as a Moses, Aaron, I will bless those that bless you, Aaron, and I will curse those that curse you, not Aaron, Abraham. He didn't say, I'm going to allow them to be cursed. He's going to bring forth the curse. He brought forth the curse to Pharaoh. He brought forth the curse to Egypt. He brought forth the curse. As we keep on going with this story, we're going to find out he brought forth the curse to a lot of Israelites because they did not do something. One thing we learn in life is that we need to listen to the fear of the Lord because he does have power. And we, like, go ahead.
I'm interested in what Josh, you said, and I think of God in terms, well, I think of parenting in terms of God parenting us. When your daughter does or son does something wrong, does the devil spank him or do you?
Sure.
You inflict pain on him. And I also realized even in this conversation coming out of the churches that we've been in, a lot of Christians actually believe that Satan can create, and that's wrong.
Moses, when he called out to Yahuwah, go ahead.
Well, I'll say on those lines, too, it's a real common misconception that the angel of death killed all the firstborn under the 10th plague when God said, I will kill
I have done it.
The firstborn.
I have killed the firstborn. I have killed the kings of Egypt. I have done this.
Yeah.
He didn't allow them to die. He killed them. We don't believe God is a killer. For crying out loud, what happened in the flood?
Yeah.
Didn't he kill an awful lot of people? Didn't he kill an awful lot of animals? Is God a murderer? We don't like him because he kills people? I'm sorry. He's a very powerful... What does El Shaddai mean?
Destroyer.
The destroyer. The one that brings forth the deluge to wipe out life. But we say, oh no, God is God of love. But he says, I am sorry I ever did this. Wow. I want to go back and explain that. But you understand that we in the Christian world have this concept that God is so gentle, so kind, and so wonderful, so beautiful. And yet, even the Messiah said, guess what? When I come, I'm going to come with I'm going to have a little maple leaf in my mouth and a dove, and I'm going to be able to, I'm going to come with what in my hand? sword. His, out of his mouth is going to be a sword of fire. You know what fire does? It kills. It burns. You read Revelations, it's a total destruction. When you read, we think, oh, it's just a prophecy. Is it, he could have prophesied what's going to happen. No, he's in control of the entire scroll. When he was given that scroll, what did the 24 elders do? They took the crown off, boom, and bowed down before him. He now is complete control. He now has complete authority. All power and all authority has been given unto me. And it says here in Corinthians, he will not turn it back over to his Father until all principalities are under his feet and they are alive? Ashes. They don't exist. You ever burnt a piece of wood? Can you ever put it back together again, a piece of wood? No. That, when God teaches us what's really physical, he explains to us what he is. He is all powerful. He can wipe out your life as if you never was. You had another statement? I thought someone did.
I really appreciate I don't know, I feel like I have never heard this kind of stuff in my life, really. I mean, it's always been, like Kathy said, just from a totally different perspective. But I still do have a question, because I'm just trying to wrap my mind around this. It's hard, you know? But if, you know, in the Garden of Eden, everything was as it should be with God and man, and, you know, Adam and Eve walked with God, and you know, there was no sin. There was nothing to separate them. There was no sickness. There was no death, no disease, nothing, right? So it was as, and then, you know, Yeshua is the first Adam, it says. So.
Second Adam.
I'm sorry, second Adam. That's what I meant.
And the last Adam.
And the last. So, you said God creates everything. So does that mean he created sin or that they did? Because, you know.
Ask yourself a question. What did he plant in the garden?
Yeah, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
Hebrew is good and bad, not good and evil. That means that when you partake of knowledge, you're going to have two things come out of it. You're either going to act on that knowledge to do good, or you're going to act on that knowledge to do bad.
Mm-hmm.
The simplicity of that statement, and as he put them in the tree. I've heard all doctrines of people saying he didn't do a single thing. God didn't create anything like that. And though he said, I put them there, I did it, I planted them, it's my tree. I don't want you to touch it. All right? But remember, they were deceived. Lied to. Told something just the opposite, but the truth is. The devil can never tell a half-truth. I'll yell as loud as I can. He had no idea what truth is. The truth comes out of the word of the creator of heaven and earth. Lies come out of the devil's mouth. He cannot say a single thing that's true. He didn't know how. Yes.
Can I just, so when sin entered into the garden with Adam and Eve, when they sinned, they brought with that a curse upon themselves.
On themselves.
Know. So sickness was able to enter the world, death, all the bad stuff was able to enter the world. Now, how did it enter? Did God throw it in there, or did, like, the, you know, he handed over control to the devil to oversee? Because I thought the devil's called the prince of the power of the air.
One of them, yeah.
So if he has control, you know, over the air or whatever, then control over what? Over what God has in his, you know, his plagues and everything? Or does he have his own stuff, you know, like
he's got his own stuff.
Sickness. Yeah. So what is
his
stuff then? If it's not sickness, then what is it?
Because he said the purpose of the Son of God was to destroy the works of the devil.
And it had not yet been done.
Say again?
Not yet been done.
Well, yeah, sure. What he did, the finished work at the cross.
So what is the work of the
fully...
devil? What's the work of the devil?
Kill, steal, and destroy.
Lie.
Sin, sickness,
how
and death.
How do you kill the lie?
With
truth.
Sure.
That's how you kill a lie. All right? You don't kill a lie any other way except by truth.
So you're saying the works of the devil that the scripture is referring to is lies, not so
lies,
much
lies.
Sickness,
how many
sin,
people
or death?
Have you known in your life, your short life, you know they've been lied to, but they believe it?
Sure.
It's abundant, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I'm still sorting out my own lies, to be honest with you.
Well, that's what the days of unleavened truth is all about. That's what the 7 days you were taught. 7 days you're given the truth of God. 7 days given the truth of God. Now what do you do with it? We're going to find out this journey as they go on to find out and get onto the threshing floor. One of the big things they have to get into their head and into their mind is, I will heal you. Yes, you are cursed. Yes, you received heavy damage. I only got rid of the Egyptians at the water. I haven't got rid of your bitterness. I haven't got rid of your lies. I haven't got rid of there. And he said, I want you to do, I'm doing this test to you. I'm testing you out with this bitter waters to find out whether or not you as an individual person, you will hearken unto the voice. Because Adam and Eve hearkened in the voice of the snake.
Yeah, I'm always saying this. It's all the way through scriptures. This is just coming back to saying it's always about choosing blessings or curses. You choose the truth and you get the blessing. You choose the lie and you get the curse. So similarly, back to the Garden of Eden, it's almost like the home you provide for your kids, a safe environment. You tell them, don't touch the pan on the stove. You're not to touch that. They get hold of the pan off the stove in disobedience, and they pull boiling water over themselves, right?
So, did they burn themselves?
Well, it's cause and effect, obedience. You get blessings and safety, disobedience, and you get the result of your disobedience.
Sure.
It's there and it's perfectly safe in the world. The garden was perfectly safe as long as they did what God asked them to do.
Okay.
And they didn't.
So God established that framework, though, not so
let me ask you. Let me,
it's a cause and effect or a principle of if you do this, you get this consequence.
This is the world he created. With possibilities. It's not a robotic world. It's a living, breathing organism. And so you can reap safety, protection, or destruction. It's as simple as that. And I do believe the enemy works in that realm, but he can't create it. It's a result of your yielding to his lies.
Okay, before, one more statement here. I got to move on. Okay, would you just quick?
Yeah, just maybe a point of clarification. The word for sin is chet, which means target, or I'm missing the target. So the lie is that there is another target besides God's target. So if you're shooting, the reality is that the only target that exists is God's target. Now, if you are convinced to shoot somewhere else, you're going off of that target. You're rebelling against the fact that God has a target, and that is the only target that really exists. So you're basically shooting it at a phantom target.
Okay, let me ask some of you people some questions. I got to move on here, if you don't mind. I mean, we got all inputs, and I'll hear your inputs, but I want to ask you a question. Has God ever brought out of your innermost part bitterness that you did not know you had? What did you do with that bitterness? The only way you could get rid of that bitterness is what? Hearken unto the voice of Yahuwah thy Elohim, and does whatever is right in his eyes, and hearken unto his commandments, and keep all of his statutes, that none of the sickness and bitterness which I laid upon Egypt, I'm using those words now, will I lay upon you, for I am your healer. I will heal you from your bitterness. I'll remove it from you. Did God bring them to this point where they had to face bitterness? Yes. Now, there's a very important... Go ahead, Ellie.
A lot of you have known me for several years. I've been sick for 3.5 years. I didn't know it until these days of unleavened bread. My eyes were bad, which I had neglected to do something that was hard because I didn't want to do it. And then, my lungs. And I didn't realize I had a bitterness that I have had for 50 years. And that was what has made me sick for 3.5 years. I expect by Shavuot that I'm going to be fine. But it was sin. And I waited. I tried everything. I tried to fix it. I didn't know what it was. Didn't make it go away. I still was sick there for a while. 3.5 years ago, I thought I might die. That was from God.
Right. When you have bitterness, resentment against somebody in your heart, it has to be brought out. You have to face it. If you don't face it, you will die. And the only way you can survive is when you take that bitterness, bring it out, look at it, and say, "Oh, Father, I'm going to get rid of this." He says, "Listen to me. Hear me. Respond to me. I will heal that bitterness. I will heal that resentment from your soul, from your mind, from your innermost part of your being." A lot of us have lived and grown up. How many times, don't ask questions, Pastor, when you've had a divorce in the family, there's bitterness that rises up. Children receive the bitterness. And the children grow up to be adults. They remember the bitterness. And they begin to pass it on to their siblings or their own children, their own husband, their own wife. It passes on and goes on and on and on and on. You have to stop it in your world today. Before they could receive the Ten Commandments, understand the Word of God, they had to get rid of the bitterness. So He deliberately gave them bitterness. And guess what? He healed the water so they could partake of it so they would know something. He will. Do you think those Egyptians, Israelites came out of Egypt and with no resentment, no bitterness, no harsh out, no anger against the Egyptians? Do you think they were just pure of heart, full of understanding, compassion? Absolutely not. Same time, how do you get rid of it? Because you know what happens when you have bitterness in you? It begins to consume you. And it will destroy you. You have resentment in you, it's going to destroy you. Doesn't help the person that you're bitter against. Doesn't affect the person you resent. It is you that are being tested with that. And you have to say, "I've got to purge it from my world." And the only choice you have is listening to the Word of God. Now, we have a wonderful thing called the Spirit of the living God living in us. We have this incredible, we can call upon Him for all strength, all power, all, and have Him wash it and purge it from our heart, our mind, that it never, ever returns back.
Well, I was just going to say, if you have something against someone, the Scripture also says to go to that person, right? Is that what you're saying? Because I didn't hear you say
true.
That.
Well, it's true. But if I have resentment against somebody in the world, I go to them, yeah, I don't expect them ever to receive it. That's okay with me.
Yeah, but what about a brother? Not
same
just
thing.
Someone
if I offended you, I can go to you and I tell you it.
Sure.
And if you don't accept, receive it, that's okay. It's I have to remove it.
That's right. As much as it's dependent on you, though, you did that. Even
right.
though if I didn't,
and so
you know,
that's what you do. You act upon
yeah,
those
okay.
things.
Okay. I just didn't hear you say that.
So when we talk about the water of bitterness, God led them to the water of bitterness for a reason, for a purpose. He didn't make a mistake. And He deliberately did it, and He put and had Aaron show of Moses a particular tree. We have no idea what it is. I'm not going to try to identify it. I don't care what its roots, its leaves, anything else about. Just tell you what it says. Okay? And we know that it says, one of the things about the tree of life, it says the leaves are healing leaves. That's a spiritual concept. I don't know if there is a tree out there that really can turn water. It may. I don't care. I want to look at what's going on. Why did He do this? Why did God do this? What was His purpose? To teach them something, to show them something, to find out something, to tell them where they're going. They did not know where they were going. They thought they were going to the promised land. Guess what? You can't get into the promised land if you don't have the commandments. You cannot enter into the Holy of Holies if you disobey. What did Jesus say? If you love me, you will do what? You better pay attention to His commandments. Pay attention. Yeah, He died for you, loves you. But He says, you know, if you want to return love to me, listen to me. By the way, do you think Jesus is a wimp? Do you think he's a nice guy and he's better than the God of the Old Testament was? He's more gentle. He's more kind-hearted. He has more compassion. Or if you do, you've got a wrong interpretation of him. He said he's got a sword. He says, I came not to bring peace, but to bring a sword. Against what? Mom, dad, brother, sister, aunt, families are warring amongst themselves. And he wants that so that the people will, in a sense, stop fighting. You have resentment against a brother, your flesh and blood brother, your flesh and blood sister, against your mom, against your dad, against your aunt, against your uncle, against your mom, mother-in-law, your dad, father-in-law, somebody. You got resentment against them. You got bitterness against them. The only way you're ever going to win is to go before the Creator of heaven and earth and say, heal me from this bitterness. It is a horrible thing that I'm living through.
Joshua, oh, he left. Okay. One thing about this issue of going to a person and making amends. Okay, to me, there is an instance that you do that. If they have been kicking your dog every day and you go in and you say, you know, I'm really sorry, I'm mad at you that you've been kicking my dog, and I need for you to please stop it because I don't like to have my dog kicked. Okay, and the person can say, wow, I didn't even see the dog there, and I'm really sorry. And I think that, in that instance, that applies. On the other hand, let's say I've been sleeping with Richard's brother for the last 5 years. But see, I didn't tell him because it was 5 years ago. And so I say, oh, by the way, Richard, I need to confess something. I've been sleeping with your brother for 5 years. Now, I feel a whole lot better about that now. See, I confessed it. He doesn't feel so good. Okay? You can turn that concept into horrible destruction. All right? If I've been doing that, I need to say, man, Ellie, you are a real jerk. Why don't you stop doing that and be really nice to him because he's a good man? But to turn around and take my guilt, which happens a lot, and turn around and dump on him, I feel wonderful. I just destroyed his whole life. And so to me, there's a time to do that, but there's a time not to, because I'm not going to tell him that just so that he feels better. I'm going to tell him that to get rid of my own guilt. That's different. So there's a different instance that doesn't apply.
You go to Numbers, the fifth chapter. Let's talk about example, what she has just got to say. About the husband who is jealous. His wife is doing something. And she has to go through a process. That's called bitter waters. It's called bitter waters. If it does not turn bitter in her stomach, it says she is free. Free from what? If she was not guilty in the first place, what is she free from? Free from her husband. From his jealousy. He's still jealous, envious, doesn't like her. But she's now free. She no longer has to live under that horrible burden. Now, last part of that, just a minute. If she is found to do so, then she will partake of the bitter. The water will make her sick, make her body sick physically. And the water starts out with holy water or sanctified water within the temple or within the tabernacle, and mixed with the soil that's on the ground, which is holy soil, purified soil. Take your shoes off, you're in the presence of God. It's mixed with purified water. If she partakes of it, and if it's bitter to her, she's out of there. She cannot return. And her husband will not be guilty of inequity. If she is innocent, her husband is guilty of inequity.
Well, there would be one exception to your rule. Truth comes out one way or another. And for an example of the adulterous wife, well, the adulterous wife can hide it for a very long time unless something else happens to her. What if she gets pregnant by her lover. She gets a disease from her lover. So the, you know, I can understand you're saying, you know, if all I'm doing is just relieving my guilt because I feel so guilty, I'm just going to dump on him. That's not the right purpose. But if you have, if that in that situation, she has discovered a much deeper issue even, she has, you really have no choice. You've got to confess that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go on. One more thing. I've got about 10 more minutes left. If anybody got a little quick comment about it, I'm still going to talk about bitterness. I hope you kind of get a little picture of what, why would he have to, why would the eternal creator of the earth have to make the people face something about bitterness first, before they can go on to hear the Ten Commandments? It is a testing process. Can you do this? Can you hear? Can you hearken unto? Can you respond? Can you live by it? Can you accept it? And the first thing that you and I and every human being has to do is get rid of the purge. Purge it out. You went through the days of unleavened bread, hunky-dory. You learned to put out sin, hunky-dory. You learned to put out lies, hunky-dory. But after the 7 days of truth, now you really got to face truth internally within yourself. Am I reading this whole thing wrong? Let's turn to Colossians. Just in case you think I got it wrong. Colossians. New Testament time. Colossians chapter 3. Starting verse 18. I'm going to read part of this. I'm not going to give you a big spew about it. But it says, wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands, and it is fit in the Lord. Husband, love your wives, and be not bitter against them. Oh, wow. Yes, there it is. He's telling them, get rid of the bitterness. Oh, do you have bitterness towards your wife? Well, you gotta be careful. Children, obey your parents in all things that is well-pleasing. Fathers, provoke not your children to anger, or else they'll be what? Discouraged. No hope. Nothing. They give up. James chapter 3. James chapter 3, starting in verse 10. Out of the same mouth proceeds blessings and curses. My brother, these things ought not to be so. Does a fountain send forth same sweet and bitter water? No. Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives? No. Neither a vine or a fig? No. So can a fountain bring forth salt and fresh? No. Who is wise man and endures with knowledge among you? Let him show himself a good conversation in his works with meekness and wisdom. But if ye have bitter envy and strife in your hearts, glory not. And don't lie. Face it. Now, when we quote, this is after the death and resurrection of the Messiah. This is many, many, many years later. And he's telling the brethren, the people that he is writing to, get rid of the bitterness. And it's not that, oh, well, what am I going to do? How do you get rid of the bitterness? You listen to the word of the Messiah. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. What do you think his commandments is? Go ahead and I command you to have hatred or bitterness or resentment against your fellow man. No. He said, go to him. Find out. You have got to solve the problem. All right. Now, bitterness. Let's go on. Revelations chapter 8. You say, God never sends bitterness to anybody. Nobody gets bitter. God will never reveal bitterness to me. Never. Oh, wait a minute. Let's take a look at Revelation 8 chapter. Starting in verse 10. And the third angel sounded, just the shofar or the horn of the trumpet. And there fell a great star from heaven. Didn't it come from above? Did it come from above? Or did it come from beneath? Did it come from the earth? Or did it come from above?
Above.
Who's in charge of the trumpets? Who's in charge? The Messiah is in charge of the Messiah. He's the one that's telling them to do. Now that angel, he's got a name, got a very specific name. He's going to come down. He's going to bring something with him. And he is going to burn as with the lamp, filled with up to the third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of the water. And the name of the star is called?
Bitterness.
Oh, what happened there? That's a horrible name for an angel, isn't it? No, it's the actions that the angel's going to be doing. When God uses a name, he uses a name to tell you what that job was or is to be. What is this angel going to do? It says here, a third part of the water became wormwood, and many men died. Oh, I thought they lived. Died of the waters because they were made bitter. See, did he cast this thing on the rivers and the waters of people who are not bitter? You know, it says there before all stuff began, and I think it was in the, you might be correct, it's between the sixth seal and seventh seal, I'm not quite sure right offhand, but the 144,000 and then the innumerable multitude, and it says nothing will harm them. Nothing will harm them. You will not be affected by this bitterness at all. You'll be affected by it. Unless, of course, you haven't gotten rid of it yet. Chapter 10, Revelation, verse 9. And I went into the angel and said unto him, give me, this is about the scroll, or I mean a book. Give me a little book. Anyway, give me the little book. And he said unto them, said unto me, take it and eat it. You know, before he ate it, he was told what was going to happen to it. It shall make thy belly bitter, but it shall make thy mouth sweet as honey. And I took the little book out of the angel's hand, and I ate it up. It was in my mouth sweet as honey, and as soon as I had eaten it, my belly was bitter. Now the angel says to him, guess what you're going to be doing? You're going to prophesy one more time, John. And what you're going to say is not going to be pleasant. Did God make John eat bitter stuff? Yeah. Now he must reveal that bitterness. He must expose it. He must tell everybody what's going on. So, as we travel on our journey, you can say, yeah, they tempted God. They actually didn't listen to him. They didn't respond to him. And did he give them, led them directly to a place where the water was bad? Yes. What was he telling them when he said, I will heal you? Was he telling them, I know you got a flu, I know you got a stomach ache, I know you got a headache, I know you got your big toe hurts, you know, I know that maybe, you know, you got bowel problems, I'll heal all that. No, was he talking something much deeper? I want bitterness. I don't have any bitterness. Don't kid myself. I didn't walk in my life never having it when I was young. I always had bitterness against my mother because of the way she always treated me. Until I finally learned why she did what she did. And all of a sudden, it didn't matter anymore. But I kept asking God, what's going on? What's going on? What's going on? And my mother knew because she already resented me. And she never, ever, ever was able to correct it because she had so much bitterness in her. But it removed from me completely. So when the resurrection comes, I'm going to say, hey, Mom, it's gone. It died when you died. It no longer exists anymore. Welcome to life. All right? Any more comments? I guess I'm already ready to go out. Yes?
I can't raise my hand. I got my finger in about 12 places. But I'll try and summarize it with one. I'm worried about one thing, and that is, and please be patient with me, whether or not anybody can be totally obedient to obeying the law.
True.
Well, that just took my whole argument away. You agree with that statement?
Agree with what, Doc?
Well, the part of being obedient, you try to be obedient, but you got to admit you're not going to be obedient. Nobody was, nobody will be.
That's true, but you're looking at the heart of the person. If you fall upon the rock, you're going to get hurt. Woe be unto you, because you will fall. I fall. If many people fall on the rock, they get hurt. Don't let the rock fall on you.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay, I took my finger out of 11 places, and I'll just finish with this then. But I think if I just want us to remember, if perfection could have been attained through the Levitical priesthood on the basis of the law was given to the people, why was there still a need for another priest to come, one on the order of Melchizedek, not on the order of Aaron?
Okay,
Yeshua had to come to fulfill.
Okay, I will explain.
Well, we can't be obedient.
That's true. That's not an issue, but we can respond to obedience. We're going to fall short.
We do our best, but we're going to fall short. Okay, I feel better now.
What did John say? The first book of John says, the lust of flesh, the lust of the eye, the pride of life. We all sin and fall short. Yeah. That's okay with me.
Okay.
That's
I'm okay too now.
You're right.
I was kind of hearing that I had to really get it all together.
Oh, no.
And I didn't. Okay.
The main thing he wants you to do, if you got to not just listen to him once in a while, you got to keep on listening to him. Keep on hearkening to him. Keep responding to him. He's always talking. He's always talking. God is probably the biggest talker in the world. Really. Says the same thing over again, over and over and over and over, but he's the biggest talker in the world. Yeah, we have it all over the place, you know. We just have to listen. And be honest with you, if you want to know what he has to say, you can't ask any human being. You're going to have to ask the Creator of heaven and earth. Because that's where he wants your heart to be. With him. Not with some organization. Not with some church. Not with some group of people. Not with some ecclesia. Not with some big-named evangelist. That's not where he wants you to be. I'm not against those people. But he doesn't want you. He wants you to be with you. And he wants you to be with him. As I said yesterday, or two or three days ago, how was it like being related to the Creator of heaven and earth? How is that? What kind of guy is he? Who is he? Do you like him? Or do you... What is it? You're related to the Creator of heaven and earth. You call him Father, right?